You know, when we think about the concept of a family reunion, there's usually this really idyllic picture that comes to mind.
Oh, absolutely. Like the perfect backyard barbecue.
Right. You picture laughing over old memories, maybe, some potato salad on a paper plate.
Yeah, the whole Norman Rockwell thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I mean, for so many people listening to this right now, walking into a family gathering feels less like a celebration and, well, more like navigating a highly explosive minefield.
Oh, it's deeply fraught territory. I mean, decades of unspoken resentment, rigid family roles, and just perceived slights. They can all detonate just because someone used like a specific tone of voice while asking you to pass the salt.
Yeah, it's wild how fast that happens.
It really is. And the tension is incredibly thick because family is where our rawest psychological wiring actually gets laid down.
And we tend to treat this like it's a uniquely modern neurosis, right? Like it's a symptom of our high-stress, hyper-connected era.
Totally. We blame it on modern life.
But today, we are taking a custom-tailored deep dive into a stack of notes based on this fascinating document called Anatomy of Conflict. And we're going to look at some of the absolute oldest literature in human history to decode the psychology of human rivalry.
And the overarching theme of these sources is just incredible. The dynamics of jealousy, the outrage of perceived unfairness, and the bitter sting of sibling rivalry. They literally haven't shifted a millimeter in thousands of years.
Not a single millimeter. So, here is our mission for you today. We are going to unpack the hidden meanings behind the biblical stories of sibling rivalry.
Specifically from a Christian perspective, though.
Yes, exactly. We'll be starting right at the dawn of the biblical narrative with Cain and Abel. Our goal is to see how these ancient texts aren't just, historical tales or dusty Sunday school morality plays.
Oh, they are definitely not that.
Right. They are functioning as this brutal, unflinching mirror. They reflect our daily, ongoing struggles with what it actually means to be genuinely obedient to God and how that obedience directly translates into our service to humanity.
Yeah, because the texts we are looking at do not look away from the darkest, most uncomfortable parts of human nature. They actually force the reader to stare directly at them.
Okay, let's unpack this because we are bypassing the Sunday school recaps today and jumping straight into the architecture of the very first human conflict.
Right into the deep end.
Exactly. So, in the Genesis narrative, we are barely out of the Garden of Eden. Humanity's relationship with God has fractured, and the immediate downstream effect is just, well, it's catastrophic.
The fallout is instantaneous. I mean, as soon as the vertical relationship with the divine is severed, the horizontal relationship between humans shatters.
It's a chain reaction.
It is direct causal link. The very first human interaction recorded outside of that perfect garden setting doesn't just feature a minor argument, it culminates in fratricide.
A brother murdering a brother in a field.
Right. It goes from 0 to 100 immediately.
The pacing of that deterioration is stunning, but the notes highlight a specific pivotal moment right before the murder actually happens. God approaches Cain, who is he's already simmering with this intense, bitter jealousy.
Because Abel's sacrifice was accepted and his own was not.
Right, exactly. So God issues this warning, and I'm quoting Genesis 4:7 here. He says, "If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it."
Man, that verse operates as the psychological bedrock for literally everything that follows in the biblical narrative.
The imagery is absolutely terrifying because I think we typically conceptualize a sin or a flaw as this like static thing.
Like a smudge or something.
Yeah. We view it like a stain on a white shirt that you just can't wash out, or maybe a bad habit like biting your nails. But the text doesn't describe it as a passive state.
Not at all.
It describes it as a feral, predatory animal stalking you on your own front porch. It is literally crouching at the door, studying your routines, just waiting for you to turn the knob so it can pounce and consume you.
That feral animal analogy captures the Hebrew phrasing perfectly. And if we look at the mechanics of what is happening in that verse, we see three massive theological concepts established simultaneously.
Okay, lay them out for us.
Well, the first is the duality of the human condition.
Which means what? We aren't inherently locked into being just the hero or just the villain.
Exactly. We carry the capacity for both Abel's devotion and Cain's narcissism in the exact same heart. It's the same human family, the same human mind.
Wow.
We possess the potential for righteous sacrifice, but we also house an incredible capacity for deep-seated resentment and violence.
That's a heavy realization.
It is. And the second concept is what you just pointed out regarding the nature of the threat. Sin is an active, hungry force. It desires to have you. It has an actual agenda.
Which is such a creepy way to think about our own bad habits.
It really is. And that brings us to the third, and honestly the most crucial concept, human agency.
Right, because of what God tells him next.
Exactly. Notice the phrasing of God's command. He doesn't tell Cain that because the predator is on the porch, he is doomed. He explicitly commands him, you must rule over it.
So the tragedy isn't that Cain had a dark thought.
Right.
The tragedy is that he had the capacity to stop it, and he chose not to. He opened the door.
He yielded. Conflict and violence are not presented as some unavoidable destiny in this text. God is commanding Cain to master his darkest impulses, which implies that humans possess the actual structural capacity to do so.
And that completely redefines what obedience actually means in a daily context, doesn't it?
It changes everything.
Let's tie that to the listener's everyday life.
Yeah.
True obedience isn't just about, you know, perfectly following a checklist of rules. It is the active, grueling process of recognizing your own agency.
Yes, the daily work.
Exactly. When you feel that predatory resentment rising up, maybe you were passed over for a promotion at work, or you're dealing with a really toxic dynamic in your family, you are not a helpless victim to your own worst impulses. You have the God-given agency to recognize the threat and rule over it.
And Cain fails that test catastrophically. He allows the resentment to turn into hatred, and the hatred into murder. And then, when confronted by God afterward, Cain offers that famously cynical deflection, right?
Am I my brother's keeper?
Exactly. Am I my brother's keeper?
Which just hangs in the air for the rest of human history. Because if Cain failed to master that impulse, the lingering question is whether it's even possible to suppress it once the feral animal is in the house.
Is anyone actually capable of keeping the door shut?
Right. And the author of Genesis essentially uses the rest of the book to answer that specific question, setting up what the notes call the Genesis Matrix.
The author functions almost like a clinical psychologist here. He repeatedly subjects subsequent generations to the exact same pressures: favoritism, jealousy, limited inheritance, just to see how they will respond.
He just watched sibling rivalry after sibling rivalry play out.
Over and over.
But the narrative introduces a severe complication pretty quickly, because Cain's jealousy was pure, unfounded narcissism. But what if the resentment is actually earned?
Oh, right. What if the anger is completely justified?
Exactly. That brings us to the next major rivalry. Jacob and Esau. Two brothers competing for the blessing of their father, Isaac.
So Esau is the older brother, the rugged hunter. He's the one entitled to the primary inheritance. And Jacob is the younger brother, the quiet shepherd who stays among the tents.
Okay, hold on. I have to step in here on Esau's behalf for a second.
Go for it.
We are comparing these two to Cain and Abel, but the dynamics are wildly different. Jacob actively manipulates a blind, elderly man.
He really does.
He puts animal skins on his arms so he feels hairy, wears the brother's clothes, and just explicitly steals the blessing that belonged to Esau. When Esau vows to kill Jacob, we can't really call that pure narcissism.
No, you can't.
From a human standpoint, Esau was robbed. If anyone has a legitimate right to be furious and want revenge, it's him.
What's fascinating here is how the narrative fully anticipates that exact reaction from the reader. We are meant to recognize that Esau's grievance is incredibly valid. The ledger of justice is totally unbalanced.
Yeah, Jacob deserves whatever's coming to him.
Right. So the setup intentionally mirrors the escalation of Cain's murderous rage, to the point where Jacob actually has to flee into exile to save his own life, just as Cain was sent into exile.
But dominoes are falling the exact same way.
The exact same way. It looks like the cycle is repeating perfectly.
But they don't fall, do they?
But they don't. The evolution of the narrative, the intentional breaking of the pattern, happens decades later in Genesis chapter 33. Jacob is finally returning home, and he hears Esau is marching toward him with 400 armed men.
So Jacob is bracing for the sword. He thinks the murder in the field is finally going to happen. This is the moment.
He expects the ancient Near East code of blood revenge to be enacted right then and there. But when they finally meet in the desert, the text tells us Esau ran to meet Jacob. He threw his arms around his neck, kissed him, and they wept together.
Man, the sheer shock value of that in an ancient context must have been staggering.
Unbelievable, really.
Esau had the military superiority. He had the justified grievance. He could have balanced the ledger right there in the sand, but he just lets it go.
He interrupts the cycle.
Yeah.
It is the biblical narrative's first great mechanical picture of grace.
I love that phrase, mechanical picture of grace.
Yeah, because grace isn't just a warm feeling here, right? It is a pattern interrupt.
Yeah.
Esau chose to absorb the cost of the theft rather than exact the revenge. He mastered the impulse.
And that completely reframes our concept of service to humanity, because we often think of serving humanity in these grandiose terms, right? Like building hospitals or donating fortunes.
A big visible stuff.
Exactly. But fundamentally, serving humanity often means being the one person in the room willing to absorb the cost of an offense to stop a cycle of retaliation.
Oh, that's powerful.
It means surprising someone with grace when they have historically earned your vengeance. You can be deeply, legitimately wronged and still choose reconciliation.
It is a profound evolution from Cain. But, you know, the text isn't satisfied stopping there either.
It pushes further.
Oh, yeah. Esau was a stronger brother, letting an offense slide. The narrative pushes the stress test to its absolute limit next. It asks, what happens when the weak, abused victim of the family dynamic is suddenly granted absolute power over their abusers?
And this leads us directly to the climax of the Genesis family dysfunction, the story of Joseph and his brothers.
The classic.
Right, we all know the basics of the setup. Joseph is the explicitly favored son. He's flaunting the ornate coat. His 10 older brothers succumb to mob mentality. They ambush him, throw him in a pit, and basically sell him to passing merchants as a slave.
They effectively erase him from the family.
Yeah. It is the Cain and Abel dynamic magnified by 10. The resentment metastasizes into a literal conspiracy to destroy their own flesh and blood.
It's terrifying how fast it escalates.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Because you mentioned the victim getting absolute power. Decades pass. Joseph doesn't just survive slavery in Egypt. Through an insane series of false accusations and years rotting in a dungeon, he rises to become the second in command of the entire Egyptian empire.
He's basically running the known world.
He is put in charge of the global food supply during a catastrophic regional famine, and eventually his 10 starving brothers show up, begging for grain, completely unaware that the powerful ruler they are bowing down to is the little brother they threw away.
It is the ultimate psychological trap.
How so?
Because historically, when a victim of severe abuse attains absolute power, the default human mechanism is to become the new oppressor. Joseph literally holds the power of life and death over the men who ruined his life. A single word and his guards would execute them on the spot.
The universe has handed him his revenge on a silver platter. I mean, it is the perfect opportunity to balance the scales, but Joseph doesn't execute them.
No, he doesn't.
After testing them to see if their character has changed over the years, he finally reveals his identity. And in chapter 50, verse 20, he delivers a statement that basically serves as the thesis for the entire book.
It's such a crucial moment.
He looks at his terrified abusers and says, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives."
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we're looking at the exact mechanism of divine providence. Providence isn't described here as God waving a magic wand to make bad things unhappen.
Right, the trauma still happened.
Exactly, it's a metabolic process.
Yeah.
Joseph realizes that God took the toxic, predatory evil of his brothers and metabolizes it, strips it down, and repurposes it as actual fuel for salvation.
So forgiveness, in this context, isn't just about Joseph being a morally superior person. It is the only psychological mechanism capable of stopping the transfer of trauma to the next generation. Because if Joseph kills his brothers, the trauma continues. Blood for blood. By forgiving them, he halts the contagion entirely.
Precisely. Joseph answers Cain's ancient question, "Am I my brother's keeper?" with his entire life. Yes, you are, even when they betray you.
Wow.
True obedience to God in the face of profound trauma means trusting that divine architecture enough to let go of your right to vengeance. Joseph transforms his deepest, most horrific personal wound into the literal infrastructure that saves his family and surrounding nations from starvation. It is the ultimate service to humanity.
The architecture of that psychological framework is so incredibly durable, so foundational to the human experience, that centuries later, Jesus uses this exact same model for his most famous teaching.
The parable of prodigal son in Luke chapter 15.
Exactly. Jesus takes the layered themes of Genesis, the favoritism, the squandered inheritance, the bitter jealousy, and the shocking application of grace, and distills them into a single devastating narrative.
It's brilliant how he brings it all together.
We don't need to rehash the younger brother's journey. We know he demands his inheritance early, squanders it on wild living, and comes home expecting to be treated like a servant. We know the father intercepts him with grace and throws a massive party.
The classic redemption arc.
Right. But the notes in our deep dive point out that the younger brother isn't the actual focal point of the tension. The true psychological weight of the parable rests entirely on the older brother.
The one who stayed home. Mm. The one who, according to a strict human ledger, was completely obedient.
Yeah. He hears the music, finds out his chaotic, irresponsible sibling is getting a feast, and he is enraged. He refuses to go inside. And when you look at his reaction through the lens of everything we've discussed today, you realize the older brother is just a modern-day Cain.
He really is.
He is standing outside the celebration, infected by the exact same corrosive resentment.
He confronts the father and essentially says, "Look at all these years I've slaved for you. I never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me a goat to celebrate with my friends."
The bitterness is so real.
It is. He reveals that his obedience was entirely transactional. He viewed his relationship with the father, not as love, but as a vending machine. I put in the coins of obedience. I am owed the candy of favor.
Think about how deeply that resonates in your own life right now. We've all felt that specific strain of bitterness. You put in the long hours at the office, you follow the rules, you stay out of trouble, you do everything right.
You play by the rules.
And then someone else, someone who cuts corners or is blatantly reckless, gets the promotion. Or they get bailed out of a massive mess. Or they get the forgiveness you feel they just haven't earned. The immediate internal response is sheer fury.
Because that fury stems from operating on a human ledger, which is strictly zero sum. If you get favor, that means less for me.
Right.
But Jesus introduces the concept of God's economy of grace. This economy operates on an infinite supply, but participating in it requires the death of the ego. It requires you to surrender your obsessive tallying of who deserves what.
And this raises an important question because the parable famously ends on a cliffhanger. The father comes out to the porch, pleads with the older brother, and says, "Everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate because your brother was dead and is alive again."
And then?
And then the story just stops. Jesus leaves the older brother standing there in the dark. We never find out if he goes inside.
He leaves it hanging because the parable isn't a history lesson. It's a mirror. The narrative tension is transferred directly onto the listener.
Oh, that's good.
Jesus is forcing the audience to answer the question for themselves. When unmerited grace is handed to someone you deeply believe does not deserve it, how will you react? Will you allow that perceived unfairness to curdle into hatred? Or will you master it, rule over it, and join the feast?
It redefines everyday obedience all over again. Obedience isn't just about avoiding a list of bad behaviors. It is an internal posture. It is doing the excruciating, painful work of letting go of our rigid ledgers so we can genuinely celebrate when grace is deployed in someone else's life. You simply cannot serve humanity if you are secretly keeping a tally of all their faults, just waiting for them to get what they deserve.
The progression we've traced today is honestly a complete roadmap for surviving the human condition.
So let's look back at the incredible ground we've covered in this deep dive. We started in a murderous field with Cain and Abel, where unchecked narcissism destroyed the first family.
A feral animal got in.
Yes. And then we moved to a dusty desert road where Jacob and Esau proved that the cycle of retaliation can be interrupted by the shock of grace. We traveled to an Egyptian palace where Joseph demonstrated that forgiveness is the only mechanism capable of metabolizing trauma into salvation.
Saving many lives.
And finally, we arrived on the doorstep of a party in the New Testament confronting the transactional obedience of the older brother. Through every single one of these narratives, the answer to the cynical question, "Am I my brother's keeper?" is a resounding, unavoidable yes.
Our spiritual maturity is directly measured by how we handle the friction of being bound to deeply flawed people.
So what does this all mean for you as you finish this deep dive? As you head back to your emails, your commute, or, you know, perhaps your own highly charged family dinner table tonight?
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Place yourself back in that cliffhanger ending of The Prodigal Son. Imagine you are standing outside that house right now. You can hear the music, the laughter spilling out of the windows into the dark.
It's a vivid picture.
Look closely at your own life right now.
Mm.
Who represents that younger brother to you, who is currently receiving a second chance or favor or grace that you secretly, deeply feel they have not earned? And more importantly, are you standing outside the party, clutching your own unmastered resentment, refusing to go in and celebrate them?
The feral animal is on the porch. The door's right in front of you. What are you going to do?
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Doing the internal work to dismantle these cycles is never easy, but it is the only way forward. Keep questioning, keep exploring, and we'll see you next time.